It's one of the most famous stories in history, the story of Cain and Abel. Taking up a mere 16 verses in the book of Genesis, the story tells of the sons of Adam and Eve, Cain who becomes a farmer and Abel who becomes a shepherd. And then, as the Nat Geo special Cain and Abel, Brothers at War explains,
both brothers try to please God by giving him thanks and offering him sacrifices. These are the first ritual sacrifices ever recorded in the Bible, as each brother makes his offering according to his own livelihood. The Bible tells us that Cain reaches out to God by offering him a sacrifice from his crops. And Abel offers God a sacrifice from his herd, his firstborn lamb. God accepts Abel's offering, but he rejects Cain's for no apparent reason.
As anyone who has heard this story knows, Cain does not take this rejection well.
Cain becomes angry and jealous of his more successful brother and lashes out.
And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel. And killed him.
The story of Cain and Abel is not unique. Conflicts between brothers can be seen everywhere in world mythology. This new arc of Undisclosed takes on a modern twist on this historical conflict. Simply put, there's strong reason to believe that Joseph Webster has been in prison for the past decade and a half for a murder that was actually committed by his half-brother, Kenny Neal. And unlike with other stories of Undisclosed, where the arc of justice is dragged on for years, due to an unexpected and unprecedented chain of events, we should know whether Joseph Webster will be a free man in a matter of months.
Welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Joseph Webster. This is the first episode in a three-episode arc about a 1998 murder in Nashville, Tennessee. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
When someone mentions Nashville, Tennessee, one thing likely jumps to mind.
She held Wanda's hand and they worked out a plan, and it didn't take them long to decide that Earl had to die.
That's right. Nashville is the country music capital of the world. But there are other sides of Nashville. One of them is Cashville, a name that derives from Young Buck's debut album, Straight Outta Cashville, about slinging dope and gun violence on the mean streets of Nashville.
All my thugs and thuggets. Walk where I walk, see what I see. May I welcome you all to Cashville, to the Kickrit. All my life I hustled all night. Now I'm all right, my wrist is all ice.
The murder of Leroy Owens occurred when Young Buck was himself a young buck back in 1998. In early November of that year, a guy named Robert Nicholas, who went by the street name Big Nick, wanted some drugs. His friend, Leroy Owens, went by Little Nick, told Big Nick that he could get some drugs from people he referred to as his cousins. Little Nick then set up a drug deal at an apartment rented by his friend, Tammy Nelson. But when the cousins came to Nelson's place, they told Little Nick that he still owed them money from a prior drug deal. Despite that prior debt, the cousins allowed the Nicks to pool their money to buy some new drugs, with Little Nick having the plan to dilute the dope and sell it at a profit to pay off his debt.
But then things went sideways. It's not entirely clear what happened. One theory is that Big Nick screwed over Little Nick. In any event, Leroy Owens was not able to pay off his drug debt. As you might imagine, this made the cousins angry. According to Tammy Nelson, one or both of the Nicks came by about five or six times in the ensuing 3 weeks, looking for Leroy Owens, including at least one time they came by when they were in a vehicle that looked like a green Ford Explorer. Then on the morning of November 22nd, 1998, Tammy Nelson paged one of the cousins to let him know that Leroy Owens was at her place. At around 11 a.m., the cousins showed up, and a physical altercation ensued, with Tammy Nelson saying that one of the men started hitting Leroy with a stick. Leroy then jolted out of the apartment, running out of his shoes as he ran down the street, and the two men left in the apartment started driving after him in a white station wagon. In this clip from the Farrier files, Dennis Farrier picks up the action a couple of blocks away.
November 1998, downtown Nashville. Leroy Owens is running down the street. A white station wagon pulls up. A man jumps out, tackles Owens, and beats him to death with a cinder block. Caves his head in. One witness said the blood covered the ground like paint. But that witness didn't see a face.
That witness was Fred Thomas McLean, a concrete worker who was building steps for a barbecue restaurant at the corner of Green Street and Charles E. Davis Boulevard in South Nashville. According to McLean, between 11:20 and 11:30 a.m., while he was building the steps, he saw two men jump out of a white station wagon and bum-rush a guy who was running away from them. One of the pursuers actually ran into McLean, knocking his head against the serve-out window of the barbecue joint. Eventually, the bigger of the two pursuers tackled the man, started hitting him in the head with an 8-inch cinder block, and asking, "Where's my money? Where's my goddamn money?" The two men then drove off in the white station wagon, and a 911 call was placed at about 11:30 a.m., with police arriving about 5 minutes later. One of the first officers to arrive was Sergeant Todd Henderson, who was told, quote, that a person named Todd, living at 113 Claiborne Street, he wanted to remain anonymous, but did want to speak to police. Sergeant Henderson relayed this information to Detective Brad Corcoran, who went to 113 Claiborne, which was between Tammy Nelson's place and the crime scene. Upon arriving, Detective Corcoran saw DeLon Patrick Hyde, who went by Todd, sitting on his car, crying. According to Todd, while he was cleaning his place, he saw Leroy Owens run up with one shoe off and bruises under his eye, asking if he could use his phone. Todd told him he didn't want to be part of whatever was going on, and Owens responded by asking if he could see a white car. Todd responded that he couldn't, and Owens started running toward Green Street, whereupon Todd did see a white Gremlin station wagon racing after him. Like Fred McLean, Todd saw two African-American men in the station wagon, and like McLean, Todd couldn't identify either of them. But he did give Detective Corcoran one vital piece of information. He had seen the same white station wagon the night before, parked at the bottom of Lewis Street, about 5 to 6 blocks away.
Later, at about 7 or 8 p.m., Detective Corcoran and Detective Pat Postiglione went to the address described by Todd, 1245 Lewis Street. The house was owned by the grandmother of Katrina Norman and Shawana Norman, who both stayed there with her. About 6 months earlier, the Gwyneth Paltrow movie Sliding Doors had premiered.
Have you ever wondered what might have been? Would things be different if you caught the train instead of missing it? How much would your life change if you were 10 minutes early?
No!
Instead of 10 minutes late.
Helen?
If I had just caught that train, I'd have been home ages ago.
The movie has led to the creation of the term sliding doors moment, a variation on the butterfly effect about how seemingly minor moments can have a major effect on the rest of a person's life. For Joseph Webster, the detective's arrival at the Norman residence was a sliding door moment, based on the fact that Katrina and not her sister Shawana opened the front door. After Katrina answered the door, the detectives asked her about the white station wagon, and she responded that she knew who owned it but refused to identify him. But while Katrina wasn't volunteering the information that they needed, the men were able to use some detective work to tie things together. Here's Shawana Norman, who overheard the detective's conversation with her sister Katrina from inside the house.
Were you there at the house when they talked
to her? I was in the living room. They talked to her right at the front door. That's why I said they never...
They did come in and sit down and talk to her?
Mm-hmm. They talked to her at the front door.
Did they take her to the station?
No.
No. How long did they stay with her?
It was a brief interaction. That's why I was like, and I think that's when they saw the tattoo on her neck. That's how they got Joseph in the crosshairs or whatever.
Because she had his name tattooed on her?
Yeah, she had his name tattooed on her neck. But and they found out that, I think they said in court that she had gotten a ticket in a car that was registered to Joseph Webster.
As Shawana notes, her sister Katrina, who was Joseph Webster's girlfriend and later his wife, had Joseph's name tattooed on her throat, and she had gotten a ticket in his car, which, in case you're wondering, was not a white station wagon or a green Ford Explorer. This allowed the detectives to create a photo array with Joseph Webster's photos and pictures of five other men that they showed to Tammy Nelson the next day. Nelson picked out Joseph's picture and said he was one of the, quote, cousins who had sold Leroy Owens the dope. Later that day, the detectives would visit Joseph Webster's mother and got his contact information. And later that night, Joseph had a phone call with Detective Postiglione and denied being involved with the murder and denied knowing anything about a white station wagon. This call took place on the evening of November 23rd, 1998.
Can't stop thinking long enough to fall asleep? Bull & Branch is here to help. Everything that Bull & Branch makes is designed with your comfort in mind. From their 100% organic cotton signature soft sheets, sheets which start out luxuriously soft and get even softer over time, to their cozy throws, to their plush towels. Bull & Branch products have thousands of 5-star reviews. Their sheets are even loved by 3 US presidents, and I might add, all 3 hosts of Undisclosed. With Bull & Branch, you can feel good about your good night's sleep, because people are at the heart of everything they do, from the farmers who grow their organic cotton to the people who sleep in their sheets at night. Then we get to love your purchase, so they offer a no-risk, 30-day trial and free shipping. But I doubt you want to send them back. Once you sleep in their sheets, you'll never want to sleep in anything else. To get you started, right now my listeners can get $50 off your first set of sheets at bullandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. So go to bullandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. Bullandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
The year 1998 ended without Joseph being arrested for the murder. So did 1999 and 2000 and 2001 through 2004. Here's Julieta Martinelli reporting on Joseph's case for WPLN.
The murder remained a cold case for 7 years until Webster came up for parole in a drug sentence he'd been serving. The district attorney's office accused him of the murder.
As Martinelli notes, in 2005, when Joseph was up for parole on an unrelated drug charge, he was finally arrested for the murder of Leroy Owens and indicted by a grand jury on June 10, 2005. His trial would then take place in late February and early March of 2006. The state's case had only 3 real pieces to it. The first was Tammy Nelson's identification of Joseph Webster as one of the, quote, cousins who'd sold Leroy Owens the dope. Second, there was Todd's statement about seeing the white station wagon outside of Lewis Street the night before. And third, there was the fact that Joseph's girlfriend had stayed at the house at Lewis Street with her grandmother. That's right. It's not the police had some breakthrough or discovered new evidence in the intervening 7 years. The case they presented to the jury was the same case they developed on the same day after the murder. And it worked. The jury found Joseph Webster guilty and sentenced him to life in prison. But then things took an interesting turn, as 4 people came forward claiming that Joseph was innocent of the murder and that someone else had confessed to the crime. Joseph's half-brother, Kenny Neal. One of those people is Marie Burns, the mother of both Joseph Webster and Kenny Neal. Here's another clip from the Farrier Files.
Marie Burns is Joseph Webster's mother. You would expect her to say her son is innocent, but there's more to this. Marie Burns has another son, Kenny Neal. Kenny and Joseph are half-brothers, and Marie will tell you her son Joseph isn't the killer because her son Kenny admitted he killed Leroy Owens.
My child came to me. We was on the porch talking, not one time, 2 or 3 times. He keeps saying that they can't say Joseph him. But they did. They did.
Marie Burns would submit an affidavit in support of her son's motion for a new trial. In pertinent part, it stated,
"My son, Kenneth Neal, told me that he committed this murder, but not to worry about it, as he had taken care of the problem and he felt that they could not prove that Joseph committed any murder. He also told me that him and Philip Cotton had taken the white station wagon to the country to be destroyed."
A second person who claimed that Kenny Neal confessed was Katrina Webster, and you might understandably discount her statement given that she was married to Joseph. But a third person is more neutral and a tougher witness to discount. That's Arthur Gordon, the brother of both Joseph Webster and Kenny Neal. Like his mother, Arthur Gordon submitted an affidavit, which stated in pertinent part,
My brother, Kenneth Neal, talked to me about the murder in this case a short time after the incident actually happened. Kenneth Neal admitted to me that he killed a man by hitting him with a brick. He told me this at his house, which at the time was off of Murfreesboro Road on Plus Park Boulevard. It turns out this is only a matter of minutes from where the crime took place. He told me this after I had inquired about where his white station wagon had been. He then told me that he got rid of the white station wagon somewhere out of town. He also stated that he did not intend to kill the man.
The fourth person to implicate Kenny Neal was Tammy Nelson, the person who had picked Joseph Webster out of the photo array in the first place. Nelson actually recanted her identification of Joseph Webster three separate times, but she gave different reasons for her three recantations and gave inconsistent post-trial testimony in which she contradicted herself on key points and walked back parts of her recantations. But there's one important point of consistency between one of these recantations and Nelson's post-trial testimony. In a statement dated January 21st, 2009, Nelson stated the following.
Tammy Nelson's recanted testimony states, quote, "I was mistaken and identified Joseph Webster as his brother Kenny Neal in court, and it's been weighing heavily on my heart to where I've been put on medication for stress and having terrible dreams."
Later, at a post-trial hearing, Nelson would testify that
the reason I saw a picture of another person, his brother, and I was like, you know, when I saw the picture, I just broke down crying because I thought all these years, and then about me being in my right mind and not on the drugs like I used to be on, that had me all confused. And now I know it wasn't Joseph.
None of it mattered. Joseph's motion for a new trial was denied. The first three witnesses were dismissed because Kenny had apparently confessed to them before trial, meaning the confessions were not new evidence, but instead old evidence that the witnesses apparently didn't report because they thought there was no way that Joseph would ever be convicted. And as for Tammy Nelson, the judge ruled that her contradictory post-trial statements and testimony rendered her recantations unreliable, a fact that caused Marie Burns particular chagrin. Again, here's Julieta Martinelli.
Burns, Webster's mother, says the woman showed up at her house one day.
She said, "Miss Marie, I am so sorry that I said Joseph was the one that did."
But when questioned in court, the woman always walked it back. A judge finally dismissed her as unreliable.
"Okay, but you took her word the first time and sent my son away. What make you think her word was good then?"
The most important time is now. The importance of feeling professional, polished, and prepared when it counts, right now. For small business owners or people who produce their own podcasts, being plugged in and prepared when an opportunity comes up is crucial. These moments happen all the time. They're happening now. And having a business card that shows how professional you are in your pocket, ready to hand out, is the first step to making something happen. Your next big opportunity is coming right now. And all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now is $10. That's a low price to have confidence that you're always ready to make an impression or get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, designs, and images that you choose means you can look and feel like a big deal, whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. First, upload your own design or start with one of their professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Second, pick the paper stock, style, and quantity that's right for you. And third, choose your delivery speed, order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. They have dozens of designs that are right for your business. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a full refund. Add your logo and contact information with just a few clicks and know you can use it on all your marketing going forward. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Just go to vistaprint.com/undisclosed. That's vistaprint.com/undisclosed. vistaprint.com/undisclosed. Frankly, it's tough to quibble with either the judge or Marie Burns. Tammy Nelson does come off as terribly unreliable in her post-trial recantations, but she also comes off as terribly unreliable in her trial testimony. So given that she was the only witness implicating Joseph Webster in the murder, where does that leave him? Well, in Tennessee and most other states, that leaves Joseph Webster in prison.
But what's interesting are how certain aspects of Tammy Nelson's story are consistent with Kenny Neal committing the crime with Philip Cotton, who Marie Burns mentioned in her post-trial affidavit. Let's start with Tammy Nelson's initial police statement about the perpetrators. Nelson said that one of the men who sold drugs to Leroy Owens had something wrong with one of his eyes, like glass or plastic on one of his eyes, with one of his eyes, quote, going up. This doesn't describe Joseph Webster, whose eyes are normal, but it does describe Philip Cotton, who was a friend and associate of Kenny Neal, but not his half-brother, Joseph Webster. Again, here's Shawana Norman.
Philip Cotton, who was he messing with?
Nobody. Nobody. His eye was messed up. And like, you know, we young and superficial and stuff. He was.
Okay.
And he was like the gopher for Kenny. He wasn't like the main person. Kenny was the one that had the money.
He was in charge.
Yeah.
And remember how Tammy Nelson had said that before the day of the murder, one of the men had driven in a vehicle that looked like a green Ford Explorer, looking for Leroy Owens. According to Shawana Norman, Kenny Neal drove just such a car.
He had an Explorer.
What color car?
I think the Explorer was green.
Now, there's no record of Kenny Neal owning a green Ford Explorer, but Shawana Norman has an explanation for that.
Kenny used to use this man's identity. This man would go...
What was the man's name?
I think it was James McLean.
McLean.
I think he would use them names to go and get cars and stuff. Or he would use the man. The man would go get the cars.
Did James McLean know?
Yeah, he knew Kenny would get them cars. He would go with them to get the cars. Yeah.
And there's corroboration for this claim. If you go to the felony offender information page of the Tennessee government, James McLean is listed as an alias for Kenny Neal. But that's not all. Vehicle registrations records show that a 1996 green Ford Explorer was registered to James McLean from February 1998 until February 1999, which includes the date of the murder on November 22, 1998. So all of this probably prompts a couple of questions. First, how did Shawana Norman play into Joseph Webster's motion for a new trial? And the answer is not at all. As noted, when detectives came to 1245 Lewis Street, it was Shawana's sister Katrina who answered the door. The police didn't talk to Shawana that day, and to the shock of Joseph's investigator...
When they were there talking to Katrina, did they see you, the police?
I don't know. But they didn't
talk to you?
No, they didn't talk to me. I've never spoken to the police about this case at all.
Wow.
Never.
So they didn't have your information, and when you took the stand, on the behalf of defense on Joseph's part. Joseph's attorney called you to the stand.
No.
Who called you to the stand?
Nobody.
Did you ever take the stand?
No.
You never testified?
No.
Okay.
A second question might be how Shawana Norman is connected to this case. At various times, she had gone out with all three of Marie Burns' sons.
That's it. But you know, the person that would know more might be their other brother, Arthur.
Is he still alive?
Yes. And don't judge me, but I mess with Arthur after I mess with kids.
I ain't here to judge you.
At the time of the murder, though, it was Kenny Norman that she was messing with.
What was your relationship with him? Were you involved with him romantically?
Yeah, I was sleeping with Kenny.
Okay.
And Kenny was married too. I was associates with his wife also.
And this is where we start entering the sliding doors territory, because you might imagine very different outcomes for Joseph Webster and Kenny Neal if it had been Shawana Norman and not her sister Katrina that had opened the door when detectives came calling. Let's start with the vehicle that Kenny Neal would drive over to 1245 Lewis Street to visit her.
1245 Lewis, down in Trimble Bottoms.
Yes.
Been down there a time or two.
We still have the house.
Do you?
Yes, I rent it out now.
Okay. So you still own it?
Yes.
Did Mr. Neal ever come to visit you there?
Yes. Yes.
Is that usually where you all met?
Yes.
You remember what kind of car Mr. Neal drove when he came to visit you?
During the time when I was missing, Kenny had, like, it was, I think, three cars. He had the white station wagon with the tinted windows. He had, I think it was...
Do you remember anything else about the station wagon? You said it was white and it had tinted windows.
Yeah.
Any kind of wheels?
Yeah, it had rims on it.
Okay.
And
that was his car?
Yes.
According to Norman, one of the days that Kenny drove the white station wagon to 1245 Lewis was likely the day of the murder, when Kenny told her about running down and attacking a man with a brick.
Kenny had told me that he had to beat the shit out of him with a brick.
Kenny Neal told you that?
Yeah. But he said he had to chase him down. I didn't put two and two together because we didn't, you know, we was young. We was having fun and stuff. We were watching the news and stuff, didn't know what was going on and stuff. He never told me that he killed the boy. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
He told me that he had to beat the shit out of him with a brick. He had to chase him down and beat the shit out of him with a brick.
Was the night or the day of this murder, is that the day that he told you that he chased the man?
I'm assuming it was because he was down to my grandmother's house with that white car. And then I think he decided, I'm thinking that was that same night that he decided, okay, I'm going to give Trey calls with Joseph. So he left the station wagon down there.
Plus, Shawana Norman gives an explanation for how Kenny disposed of the station wagon that lines up with the affidavit that was written later by Marie Burns.
They took it to, I think his name was Phil. He had a messed up eye. They took it to Phil's family's property in the country and burned it up. I do know that.
This idea that Kenny and Phil were the two men involved in the murder and the dumping of the station wagon also lined up with parts of Shawana Norman's story.
Do you know who might have been with Kenny when this murder took place, when he beat this boy with a brick?
Phil.
Philip?
Yeah, Phil. Because when he told me he had to chase the dude down and beat the shit out of him with a brick, Phil was with him when he came to my granny house.
And while it's unrelated to the murder of Leroy Owens, there's a final part of Shawana Norman's story that might lend credence to the idea that Kenny Neal would murder someone over a drug deal gone wrong.
Kenny had a Maxima. He killed a man in a Maxima. This has nothing to do with this, but he killed a man in the backseat of the Maxima.
Kenny Neal?
Yeah.
Did he get arrested for that?
No. They were in Atlanta. When he drove back from Atlanta, he came to my granny house.
How do you know he killed somebody in Atlanta?
Because he told me.
He told you?
He said they went down to Atlanta. The guy from up here had set him up with somebody down in Atlanta to do a drug deal.
Yeah.
And when they got to the meeting spot or whatever, the guy that they were supposed to be doing the deal with robbed him. And he said he didn't have a chance to get to his gun. So the guy that had hooked it all up was on the back seat, and he said that he told him he didn't know, you know, that they were going to rob him, and he don't called him. And that means shot him in the head.
Yeah.
So when he got to my grandmother's house, the back seat was full of blood at Maximum.
You saw it?
Yeah. Yeah.
We were able to obtain the files for an unsolved murder out of Atlanta that fits the timing and description of the killing described by Shawana Norman, and it presents the possibility that solving the Leroy Owens murder might help authorities solve another murder as well. So why didn't Shawana Norman come forward with any of this information at the time of trial? Well, the reason she gives is similar to the reason given by Joseph's family members.
Did you go to court?
Mm-hmm. I was there for the entire trial.
You testified?
No. This is what we figured. We figured there's no way in hell they could find Joseph guilty because we know for a fact he didn't do it.
So they rolled the dice on that and it didn't turn it up.
But according to Shawana Norman, there's also another reason she didn't want to come forward with information in this case.
And like when I heard that Postiglione was the one that was the lead investigator or detective on Joseph's case, I told Joseph, I was like, I don't know if things are going to go your way because Postiglione was the detective on our case. Me and my sister were both victims of a crime that was committed by Abu Ali Rahman. He's on death row at River Bend. Mm-hmm. Postiglione was shady, during that, and I was a kid, and I remember this, and my mama was like, he was the worst detective ever. He wanted me to do, wanted me to tell lies on the stand and everything. That's, that came from my mama, and she was the one that was actually assaulted. She was stabbed in the back when they left our house. They left the bush knife in her back and stuff.
Wow.
She said that he wanted her to lie on the stand and everything else just to convict this man.
While we don't know whether Detective Pastiglione did pressure Norman's mother to lie in the Abu Ali Abdurrahman case, we do know that she is now willing to come forward and use what she says she knows to help Joseph prove his innocence.
I mean, I pray about it, but praying about it, knowing the stuff that I know, because now if somebody were to do something to my son, I feel bad and affected. I would want them to come forward, you know, somebody, if they knew something, to come forward.
Right.
But then back then, like, it, we wasn't thinking about that. We was thinking about, oh, Kenny gonna do something to us too, so.
What we also know is that if it turned out that Kenny Neal murdered Leroy Owens, Joseph Webster wouldn't be the first man convicted for a 1998 crime that was actually committed by his brother. On January 11th, 1998, Kian Khatibi was at a Lock, Stock & Barrel, a bar in Pleasantville, New York.
Yeah, so that night involved an altercation inside of a bar. It's a local town, about 5,000 people. I grew up there and my family did as well. It's January, it's about midnight. Bunch of folks from college, back from school, whatever, mid-January. And there was a little altercation. Some guys had some beer muscles. Some football players from another village had some beer muscles inside. They're pushing people around. Then I was ejected, and then I went home. And then later, with maybe an hour or something like that, I didn't go home, actually. I walked to the store. About within an hour, these guys with the beer muscles, these two guys came out, and there was a big pushing fighting match. And I got close to it, but I left to go to a train station. I didn't want to be a piece of it. And eventually, this one of the mans was stabbed.
But while Kian had left, well before the stabbing, he somehow found himself charged and eventually convicted of assault and possession of a weapon. We can then fast forward to November 2007 and an interesting conversation around the Khatibi dinner table.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that your brother's confession all stems from a family dinner where your father had commented about feeling bad that you weren't there, right? What have you sort of heard about how that all transpired?
No, I mean, that's correct. It was around Thanksgiving, and it just was like, you know, spur of the moment, sentimental statement that was made, and family members heard it, and I asked him to put that down on paper, and those were the statements that were attached to the collateral.
Specifically, after Kian's father commented about his son's absence, Kian's brother began weeping and admitted that he had committed the stabbing. And while the brother later pleaded the fifth at a hearing on Kian's motion to vacate his convictions, the testimony of his family members about his confession was enough to exonerate Kian. In no small part due to his experience, Kian later became an attorney. And, coincidentally, as Colin called him, he was catching a ride to meet with the head of the newly formed Tennessee Innocence Project.
I'm also going right now over to the Innocence Project in New York. And out of all curious things, why you chose to call me at this moment, I'm hopping in an Uber, and I'm going over there to meet the head of the newly formed Innocence Project, this is Daniel, for Tennessee. He's in New York today. So with that said, it just seems like things somehow lined up pretty interesting here.
And as Kian explains, the scenario of someone being convicted for his brother's crimes isn't as unusual as it may seem.
Sometimes I find that the biggest hurdle is the courts just need a little catalyst, a little inspiration to make sure they're not doing the wrong thing. And I have in other cases where there's been siblings and claims of innocence, I have written detailed letters explaining that I was in the same situation, that it was not easy to make this determination to court, but they did do it. They did do it. And look at me now. It was the right decision.
So, is Joseph Webster's case one of those cases in which a man has been convicted for his brother's crime, and the powers that be just need that catalyst to take them from the status quo to an exoneration? Well, what if it turned out that there were other eyewitnesses to the murder that were never disclosed to the defense? And what if there were other reasons to doubt Tammy Nelson's identification of Joseph Webster? Next time on Undisclosed. big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Delahan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at UndisclosedPod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.